Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and our listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, our listeners in Swindon and also Radio Verulam in St Albans.
Our guests this week are Janine Marriott, who's here to talk about ferrets, and we also have Robin Whitlock, who's a freelance journalist and here to talk about Occupy Bristol and the Occupy movement as a whole. We also have regular features from Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and no Treasure Island this week, but we would like to mention that Malcolm Grieve has his second piece of work out on the US audio magazine Tales of Old. Released on October the 8th, so it's already out. It's called Theatre Conundrum and can be downloaded from www.talesofold.org. So no Treasure Island this week, but we do have at least something to announce that's new from our resident actor. Our engineer, Michael Neusen, sometime producer of articles, has taken into inviting musicians round to his house. So we will have an interview between him and Sadie Fleming, a songwriter, later on in the show.
We have poetry by one of our resident poets, and Jeff Sparks is here with the What's On Guide and Song of the Week. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. In the studio with me now is Janine. Hello.
Hello.
We're here today to discuss ferrets. We heard you in before. We were discussing steampunk. And you expressed afterwards, you said, well, I know quite a lot about steampunk, but more of an expert on ferrets.
Yeah, that may be my undoing.
So obviously we had to get you back to chat about ferrets.
Yes.
How many ferrets do you have?
I've got three ferrets.
Okay, and how long have you had those for?
I've had them for about 4 years. They're all rescue ferrets, so I don't know how old they are. They're probably about 5 or 6.
Right. How long does a ferret live for?
Ferrets live for between 8 to 10 years. So they live quite a significant amount of time.
Yeah. Did you know anything about ferrets before you got them? Or?
Yeah. I had a friend who had ferrets, and I'd spent some time with her ferrets, and I also did quite a lot of research before I got them because I wanted to know what I was getting myself into, because there are a lot of myths about ferrets, which aren't really true, mainly. Okay.
So what did you think about ferrets that later proved to be wrong?
Well, one of the main ones is that ferrets are vicious and they bite, and they, of course, any animal will bite you if you're horrible to it. But yeah, they're very gentle, very playful creatures. Other ones, the best one is that they're obsessed with going up people's trouser legs, which is just not true. That bit of urban mythology comes from the fact that poachers used to keep ferrets and they used to take them out poaching with them to catch rabbits.
Okay.
And if the gamekeeper was coming, they would put the ferrets down their trousers so they couldn't find the ferrets and get them in trouble for poaching.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's that legend came that ferrets are always down your trousers. Yeah, they are if you put them there. But no, my ferrets have never been up my trousers.
It's probably quite smelly down a pair of human trousers, I would have thought.
Yeah, I would have thought so. But then again, an unneutered ferret is unfortunately fairly smelly too.
Okay, right. I mean, do they have quite a sensitive sense of smell, like a lot of animals?
Very, very good sense of smell. They've got an incredibly good sense of smell. They use that a lot more than most of their other senses, really.
Can you train them to hunt for lost things around the house?
The problem with ferrets is they are very easily distracted by pretty much anything, so you probably wouldn't be able to train most ferrets to go hunting for lost things. Okay. However, a lot of people do use them for hunting for rabbits.
Oh, right. So it's like having a sort of small, hairy ADHD sufferer.
Yes, it is, very much so. And they've got this amazing thing where they'll be walking across the room and then just suddenly stop and walk another direction because they've gone, oh, shiny thing over there, and bounce balls and play, but they also really love to bounce and jump. They've got something called War Dance of the Weasel, which is just worth YouTubing for itself. It's hilarious, and they get very excited, and they play with each other, and they bounce up and down, and then throw themselves sideways and upside down, and fall on their backs, and bite their own bums and things. It's very, very funny.
Yeah. How do you keep them? Do you have to sort of lock them in a cage, or...?
My ferrets are house ferrets. They live in a very, very large cage. It's about 5 foot 5, roughly the same height as me, and because ferrets are a brilliant pet in the fact that they sleep for between 18 and 20 hours a day, I get up and they get up and they play and spend time in my living room, which they hang out in there and just run around. It's all ferret proofed because you can't have any holes or anything because they'll be in them.
Mm.
And then I go to work and they go back to bed. They put themselves back to bed. They just get bored and tired and they go back to bed, and then I come home in the evening and they're up for a bit more hanging out and playing and being a bit crazy. So they're very, very, very good pets in that way. It's one of the reasons they make quite good pets for children, because they don't need a great deal of attention when they're not awake.
So I mean, what's the difference really? I mean, like, not a lot of people, for example, not that I've ever heard, have, say, weasels or pine martens or stoats as pets. So what's the deal with ferrets in particular? I mean, what are the differences between them and all the other types?
Well, they're all related. They're all the mustelid family. But the weasel and the stoat and badger, things like that, they're all wild animals. There's really no, well, in Europe, there's no wild ferrets. They're only domesticated. They've been domesticated for thousands of years. The ferret is mentioned in the Bible, in fact, and there's medieval pictures of, I think it's Holbein, I think it's woman with weasel, something like that. There's a Holbein picture. Yeah. And so they've been domesticated for a very, very long time, like dogs have. Okay. So there are wild dogs in lots of other countries, but like in Europe there aren't. So yeah, it's a case of...
So their usefulness has effectively eliminated them as a wild creature?
Yes, pretty much.
Because of their sense of smell?
Yes, they're extremely useful. I mean, people have used ferrets for all sorts of jobs, as I said, the hunting, but also... In the early 20th century, electricians have used them for running cables in attics and things, because you can get them from one end to the other and bring the cables down with them.
Cool.
You can use them for all sorts of different jobs. Unfortunately, they are quite regularly used in medical experiments as well, because they have quite close immune systems to humans.
Right.
So they can suffer from influenza the same as us. So they're used for that.
So you could get a cold from your ferret if you got a bit of a sniff.
More likely you give your ferret a cold, because you're the one who goes out and interacts with other people. You sneeze on your ferret and they catch the cold, unfortunately.
Right.
But ferrets have to be vaccinated anyway, yearly.
Are they any good with kids, or do they, I don't know, how do they take to children?
Like all pets, if children are gentle with them, they're absolutely brilliant. Because they love to play and they like to be rough and tumble, unlike a hamster's a bit fragile and rabbits are a bit nervy, ferrets love to be mad and active and playing. So as long as a child treats a ferret with some kind of gentleness, then they are fantastic pets for them. As obviously, any animal has to be trained not to misbehave. So puppies are trained not to nip, and cats are trained not to chat, scratch.
Yeah.
Ferrets have to be trained not to nip as well. But okay. Once that's happened, they are fantastic pets for kids.
Okay. How do they get on with other animals? Like, you know, if you've got a cat or a dog or something?
Most of the time they get on okay. Cats get on with ferrets fairly well. Dogs, probably not so much, depending on the size of the dog. But if animals have been brought up at the same time, they usually get on very well. I do know several people who've got dogs and cats that and ferrets that all hang out together, basically. But they've all been brought up with each other. I wouldn't necessarily introduce a large dog to a ferret, for example.
Because you might hunt it.
Yeah, well, more to the point, the ferret might try and take on the dog. I take my ferrets for walks. It's good for them to get out and hang out, and they like to dig in the grass and things. So I take them for walks on a lead.
Yeah.
And particularly my ferret called Magellan, who's called Magellan because he was found wandering in a park and he likes to explore, he will take on anything. He'll go up and sort of do face-to-face with dogs and cats and all sorts, because they're an obligate carnivore. They're a meat eater, and they're designed and they're trained and now domesticated to hunt.
So you have to keep your eye on it if there's... another animal around.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely. What about other continents then? Are there sort of ferrets living like in the Americas or anywhere else? Or
there is a very, very rare ferret wild living in America called the black-footed ferret, and they're extremely rare. There are more, I think, in zoos than there are in the world now. That's partly due to the fact that well-meaning people tried to vaccinate them against a disease they can catch from dogs called distemper. Fortunately, the wild ferrets weren't used to being vaccinated, and quite a number of them died from the vaccination. Obviously, domestic ferrets can cope with that kind of vaccination.
Can you crossbreed ferrets with, like, weasels and pine martens and stuff like that?
Not with weasels and pine martens, but you can with polecats, and you will find in pet shops and things polecat and ferret crosses, where they've got quite a mask, sort of Zorro-style mask. They'll have a polecat mix in them. So, yeah, you can crossbreed those. You'll end up with a slightly more wild creature with a bit more of a temper. And
right, okay.
More of an arch in the back, because polecats have got very arched backs, unlike ferrets, which are a bit flatter.
Okay, so what sort of personality range can you get in ferrets? Are they all sort of fairly the same?
No, not at all. The female and male ferrets are quite different. The female ferrets are actually always smaller anyway, and they're more keen to hunt, and they're actually a bit more live-wired. The boys tend to be a bit more laid back, but I've got three ferrets with totally different personalities. I've got Moriarty, who is very lazy and very laid back and just likes to sit on your lap and have a cuddle. I've got Moe, who's small and cute and a bit crazy. He's pure, well, he's white, champagne coloured, hence being called Moe. And then Magellan, who's just mad, who likes to chase and run and go crazy and wild and plays all the time as much as he can. So, yeah, my guys have got lots of different personalities.
Cool. So you get some more if these ones...
oh, yeah, I would definitely get more ferrets. Yeah. I think three ferrets is quite enough.
And it sounds like they sleep quite a lot. You can still go out and have fun and leave them at home locked up for quite a while.
For quite a while, but not for too long, because they do need attention at least once a day, really. It's not fair on any creature to keep them locked up all the time if they're awake and they want to play.
Okay. Well, Ginny, thank you very much for coming in, and perhaps somebody as a result of this might be interested in looking up some more information about ferrets and get one. So until we see you again on another random topic, thank you very much.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah?
Don't get one, get a couple, because they like to live together.
Oh, they get lonely. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
To mark Anti-Slavery Day on the 18th of October, the charity Unchosen showed a film made by Channel 4 about hunting down sex trafficking gangs across Britain. After the film, a question and answer session was held, and our reporter Anthea Page spoke to some of the invited guests who were involved in trying to stop the international trade in human trafficking.
I'm at the Colston Hall, and today is...
Today is Anti-Slavery Day throughout the UK, 18th of October 2011.
Can you tell us about the charity Unchosen and why this film's been shown this evening?
Unchosen seeks to raise awareness against human trafficking. It's a huge crime, a huge scourge for modern society. There are 10 times more slaves in the world being trafficked around now than there were 200 years ago when Wilberforce outlawed slavery in the UK. It's our business to spread the word, and the film we've chosen to show in Bristol highlights the scourge of sex trafficking, where the solution is within us all to get rid of the demand as well as getting rid of the supply.
In the film, it showed that much of the trafficking goes on in suburban areas, in private houses. Do you think the public could do more by being more vigilant?
That's the only way. The public are the solution to this, not the police force, because it's happening next door to you and me, because, as you say, it does happen in suburban houses, in a place which people come and go, and that's the clue. When people come and go, strangers come and go. For neighbours to be alert that there is something unusual that we need to be aware of and to inform the authorities.
So is there a special helpline that people can ring if they see something suspicious?
Indeed, the police do have a helpline. I don't have the helpline number with me at the moment, but there is a helpline available from the police where you can phone up and tell them what's going on and they will deal with it.
Are there a lot of cars in evidence, or do people come and go during the night?
No, it's not always by cars. As we saw in the film, there are a number of pedestrians who park their car for their own anonymity. They park their car at a distance and walk to and from the house in question. So it's not always a car, but the car traffic is clearly a sign not to miss.
What other signs should people look for that might be suspicious?
Well, it's the coming and going of, in the case of sex trafficking, the coming and going of girls who don't look very healthy, who are being chaperoned all the time, strange amounts of food going in and out, which I think would be some of the giveaway signs.
And do you have a website for this charity?
Unchosen.org.uk.
My name's Ian Carr and I run the Change Course. We work with men who've been arrested for soliciting. We work across 13 different police areas across the country. And it's a way of actually making men responsible for their behaviour.
Do many men realise what they're doing, that a lot of these girls are being trafficked and are total slaves, kept in bondage?
I think most of the men that we see this as a victimless crime. So what they actually do is they turn up there and want it to be fun, want it to be exciting, want it to be something which is really interesting for them. They have no comprehension and no understanding of what they're actually involved in. They're not involved in a victimless crime. What they're actually involved in is the abuse of women. So what we try and do is educate the men to what's actually happening. And the research shows that when men have completed the course, they no longer find it exciting, equal, sexy. They find it kind of deeply disturbing that they've been involved themselves in such an industry. And our research and the police's research show that only 2% of the men then go on to reoffend again, which is really excellent.
I think a lot of them don't realise it could be their wife or their daughter or their sister.
I think that one of the points that we try to make to people is that whether it is acceptable. And one of the questions we ask the men who attend the course, would it be acceptable if this was your wife? Would it be acceptable if it was your sister? Would it be acceptable if it was your daughter? And the answer is always the same. No, it wouldn't. And it's about making men responsible for their behaviour, making men responsible for their actions. Because for me, prostitution is demand-led. The more men demand, than what actually happens, the more women are actually put out there or trafficked into the country. If we make men more responsible for their behaviour, the demand falls, therefore there'll be fewer women trafficked into the country, fewer women on the streets actually soliciting.
Do you think the public could help support the trafficked women more by donating money and their time and energy?
I think the best thing to do is for the community to actually support those charities which are actually involved with anti-trafficking and with women involved in trafficking. I think that that would be a great way to step forward. Whatever you can offer, the charity will take it, I promise you.
I'm here now with
Sue Bradshaw, a detective inspector with the Public Protection Bureau based in Gloucestershire.
Who appeared on the Channel 4 film. Tell us more about that.
Yes, it was a film that was put together over a period of months whilst we did Operation Pentameter 2, which started in October 2007 and ran through until June 2008. And we worked really closely with a film company who followed the investigation from start to finish and pieced together activity as it unfolded.
I think we all had tremendous admiration for the way the operation was handled and the amount of evidence you managed to extract from very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, it was quite painstaking at times, but we concentrated on the assets and we managed to seize a number of exhibits which followed the financial trail. And that's in the end what we were able to achieve at court by stripping the assets away from some of the criminal networks that were involved.
Now, you mentioned the financial trail. Do you think the letting agents, because in the film it did show that people had gone to estate agents and rented houses for cash, considerable amount of cash, do you think they could do more to help the police?
I think they certainly could, and it was something that we tried to raise awareness and trying to encourage them, but it's quite difficult for them at the outset to really form a view about whether somebody is a criminal, and it's really lucrative for them at the end of the day because they're receiving large amounts of cash, so it's difficult for them to kind of like turn them away without really good evidence to prove that they're wanting to sort of let somewhere for a criminal activity. I think once you highlight that to them, on the whole, most of them are pretty responsible and will allowing them to let property.
Now, there's a huge amount of women being trafficked every year into this country.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's not, the figures perhaps aren't as large as you might imagine, but still it is a significant issue which still needs to be tackled.
A lot of the victims have their passports removed by the gangs when they arrive in the country. Could not something be done by customs to hold people's passports for a certain number of days from these countries where they know that the traffickers are operating?
I think it's such a large industry, and whilst that would be something that perhaps would be a good idea, I think in reality how that could be achieved would actually be quite difficult.
In what way do you think this whole problem can be tackled effectively?
I think it just has to be, as we've highlighted really, that it is painstaking work. It's got to start with communities. They've got to start looking for what is behind closed doors, for activity that is suspicious. And just by raising awareness, hopefully we can get people to start thinking about things that are going on in communities and raise the awareness, really, so that we can build intelligence and information to tackle these crimes.
But do you think generally the public should be more nosy?
Ideally, yes, about everything, because so many people just turn their eyes to what is the obvious. And so it is trying to, as I've said, raise awareness and get people to try and notice suspicious activity and report it.
Do you think the government should have more safe houses, because some of the victims had problems once they come out of trafficking, safety-wise?
Yeah, I mean, I think recently, because it has changed to, whilst there was some really specialist and fantastic accommodation that was offered in London, then unfortunately we didn't have the luxury of that in some of the provinces. So now the Salvation Army have got resources which have been funded by the government, then hopefully that should help give a more widespread approach to safe houses.
And is there enough accommodation if, supposing you were more successful in future, would there be enough accommodation for those girls to go to?
I think there always are resources that we can draw on, and I think we would find accommodation if we needed it.
Well, Sue Bradshaw, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was Anthea Page reporting from Colston Hall in Bristol at the event organised by the charity Unchosen to mark Anti-Slavery Day, which was the 18th of October this year.
Now time for a tune and something politically orientated to get you in a suitable mood for our next interview. This is Dropkick Murphys with The Workers' Song.
And counted your days. one's in line for that pie in the sky. And we're always the last when the cram is shut out. For the worker is working when the fat cats are bald. We're the first ones to starve. We're the first ones to die. The first ones in line for that pie in the sky. And we're
That was the Dropkick Murphys with the Workers song. And up next, I'm speaking to Robin Whitlock. Hello.
Hello.
And you're a freelance journalist who's been covering the Occupy Bristol camp.
Yes.
So if anyone who's been living under a rock and hasn't been past College Green for a few days, or weeks rather, doesn't know what Occupy Bristol is all about, can you give us a brief rundown of what the camp's about and why people are there?
Certainly can, yes. Well, basically, Occupy Bristol started as part of a UK movement, which was essentially copying what was going on in America. And it all started in America with Occupy Wall Street. And they latched on to the whole Arab Spring series of revolutions. And basically, a group of people decided they'd had enough of the economic system in America that was treating the bulk of the people really shoddily. And they just decided that they wanted a complete change right across the system. So they came up with this idea of occupying Wall Street and started camping out. And that spread right through the United States, and there's an Occupy group in every city now. And then suddenly came up with the idea of appealing to other cities throughout the world to do the same thing. But a number of cities, notably, as far as I seem to remember, Occupy London were going and Occupy Liverpool were going. So by the time this worldwide sort of day of action was declared on October the 15th, there was already some action going on in the UK already.
So what's your involvement been with Occupy Bristol so far?
Well, I was naturally interested in it because I specialise in environmental issues and I'm a former environmental activist. I do have my own bugbear about the economic system. So I basically took a real interest in the kinds of things they were saying. So being a freelance journalist, I also offered to cover the story for Bristol 24/7 as well. So I wrote a blog which appeared on 24/7's website. And I suppose since then I've just had a sort of a loose involvement with it, really, just from the point of view of supporting the kind of message that's coming across from the Occupy group, the Occupy movement.
Okay, we had a piece on last week. One of our reporters, Tony Gosling, went down and spoke to some people, and there was kind of a real sense of anger, and one of the key points was employment or the lack of finding good opportunities and feeling disenfranchised in that respect. Mm. I mean, is that something that you've seen down in Occupy Bristol, and what other types of people are there, would you say?
I would say that the Occupy movement brings people from all walks of life together, because there is a lot of anger about the economic system throughout the world now, but it goes wider than that, because the economic system that we've got in the world, which one commentator on Russia Today a couple of weeks ago described as corporatism, really has an effect across all walks of life, and also it has a major effect on the environment as well. I mean, just this week I've been writing a paper on climatic feedbacks, and that's actually getting quite scary now, because what's happening in the Arctic Ocean is that the methane hydrates beneath the Arctic Ocean are starting to destabilize, it seems. Now, methane is actually 25 times a global warming potential as carbon dioxide. So if 1% of that methane was to escape into the atmosphere, we could have abrupt, irreversible climate change. And to my mind, it's the corporate domination and the obsession with corporate greed that has brought us to this situation. We're on the edge of environmental disaster. So, in a sense, the kind of things that the Occupy movement are unhappy with also affects, you know, the environment as well.
Sure. Segueing beautifully in with the environment, it's getting pretty cold and people have been camped there for about 2 weeks now.
Yeah.
Also alongside the Occupy London group in St Paul's being told to move on, or you know, there's been a lot of issues with the St Paul's church authorities. Mm-hmm. How long do you think, A, people are going to be staying out there in this kind of weather, and B, the College Green, the cathedral have allowed the camp to set up and stay? Mm. You know, how long do you think this is feasibly going to be carrying on down on College Green?
Well, there's all sorts of people camped down there, and I know for a fact that some of them are former road protesters.
They're going to be sticking around there,
yes, exactly, exactly. I mean, I remember when the Newbury Bypass campaign first started getting together in 1995, and lots of people at the time in the corridors of power predicted that that was going to dissipate as the winter came along. But those guys were camped out along the route throughout a very severe winter. So I'm pretty sure that those guys up in London and on College Green will stay there indefinitely. And that's what they've said. And I'm pretty sure they've got the guts and
staying power
to stick it out.
Absolutely. What about the cathedral's kind of appetite for letting them stay? Because obviously that College Green is, as I understand it, mm. owned by the cathedral, and they have given their kind of blessing. So do you think that their appetite for this will run out?
It's difficult to say, because there's mixed voices in sort of the church at the moment, and a lot of this actually appeals to what the Church of England are saying about where we are in society anyway. So I wouldn't like to say really, but I'm pretty sure that there's still going to be some encouragement from that quarter for some time to come, actually, because I mean, we are in a pretty dire situation at this point in time across all levels. And it's interesting that the Occupy movement has happened right at this moment, and it's drawn in so many people from all walks of life. It's not just another single issue protest. It's actually coming together of people right across society who are really fed up with the way things are. You know, we're talking about teachers, nurses, doctors, trade unionists, environmentalists, transport workers, you know. In essence, really, you could actually also say that Occupy Bristol is actually not just the camp. It actually could extend to being, and I hope this would be the case, right across the city, because it's what is starting to happen in America, and it's also what needs to happen here too.
Okay, so you think that might be what's next? Because obviously it's been a couple of weeks now. People yeah. may be asking, you know, where's the manifesto? Where are the ideas for actually changing something? How are we going to amend this system which has failed so many people? Mm. Are there any building blocks from what you can see into how that might be articulated?
Not at the moment, but there again, I'm not surprised really, because you know, we need actually to formulate something new. We can't go back to the kind of patterns that we've had before in the past. We need to get together and discuss and produce something new, basically. I think one of the things that will be really interesting is when the national strike happens on November the 30th, and I think that'll be a point in time when a lot more people will get it and join in, you know. And I'm pretty sure that over time there'll be this sort of really solid debate about where we are and where we need to go and what to do next.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Robin, but is there anything that you would like to say on behalf of Occupy Bristol? Any wish list, for example, anything that they particularly like to get across?
Yeah, first thing is that they really do need support. So I mean, if there's anyone out there who really vibed what I've been saying and really have an issue with what's been going on at the moment, just go down there and talk to them and join in. If you feel like contributing something, I think with the winter coming up, anything warm, jumpers, clothes, blankets, sleeping bag, anything like that, basically.
Okay, thank you very much, Robin Whitlock. And Occupy Bristol is obviously down on College Green, so do go and see them, as Robin has suggested.
Our engineer, Michael Noyce, has taken to inviting musicians around his house for a chat, presumably a cup of tea, although that's not recorded. They also record live versions of their tracks, and this week it's singer-songwriter Sadie Fleming on the sofa.
On my sofa today I have the singer-songwriter Sadie Fleming.
Hi.
Hi. How long have you been doing music?
Well, I've been playing piano since I was really young, since I was about three. My parents got me piano lessons. And then when I was at school, it wasn't really that cool anymore. So I tried to pick up the guitar and give that a go. And then kind of late teens, I didn't really play much music at all, actually. I moved up to Sheffield, did the uni thing, got a job. I kind of forgot about music completely. And I kind of got a bit stuck, got a bit fed up, and decided that I really did just want to do music. That was kind of my passion. So moved down south. I did a course in songwriting last year. And basically, did my first open mic about a year and a half ago, which was absolutely petrifying. Started playing more and more in the area and then moved across to Bristol last year, and I've started doing gigs and stuff really, so I absolutely love it. It's it's ace.
Okay, always a very difficult question, but is there any specific keywords that would characterise your music? It's obviously difficult to put things in a genre as such these days, but
I'd say it's generally quite kind of chilled out acoustic music. The lyrics especially are kind of generally quite dark. I tend to kind of base it on personal experience when I'm writing, but it's generally embellished quite a lot. There's quite a few of my songs are kind of about death and drunk people and kind of broken relationships, that kind of thing. I've only really got one positive song, which is a song called Birds Fall, which is kind of about love, but everything else is, it's a bit sad, to be honest.
So you're not generally a miserable person?
I'm not at all, no. I'm generally really happy, but I guess that's where the misery comes out in my songs.
Okay, fair enough. I gather you've recorded the CD.
Yeah, basically as part of the course I did last year, we had to write a song every week, and then at the end of the course we had to write and record an album. So I actually had the album recorded and pretty much finished last summer, but I'd never done a gig. I think I'd done one open mic beforehand or something, so it doesn't necessarily reflect what I'm doing now as much, but I'm still quite proud of it. And I kind of recorded it in my bedroom back in Bath, programmed all the instruments and that kind of thing myself, and then I've just been saving up for the last 8 months or so just so I could get it mixed and mastered properly and get it printed up properly, and got my dad to do all the artwork on it, so it looks pretty.
Oh, well, fantastic. Okay, so we're now going to hear an exclusive live version of one of your tracks. What's this one called?
This one's called Dressed to Kill. It's kind of about the state of the human race, so another positive one.
Lovely. So this is Sadie Fleming with Dressed to Kill.
I'm not
That was Dressed to Kill by Sadie Fleming. So if people like what they hear, and they can buy your CD, can they?
Yep, it's available at all my gigs. They're basically kind of advertised on my website. And you can also buy it from my website, or you can download it for free or whatever you choose to pay, which is www.sadiestands, which is sadiestands.bandcamp.com. And I'm also on Facebook and MySpace and Reverb Nation, all that kind of thing.
And that's Sadie Fleming with one M.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And Sadie Fleming, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Sadie Fleming, and thank you also to Michael Noyes.
Well, it's just about the end of the season for two historic vessels, the SS Waverley and the SS Balmoral, that ply Britain's coastal waters through the spring, summer and autumn. These two restored ships are owned by a charity now, but still give pleasure to thousands throughout the year with their daily pleasure cruises. As the SS Balmoral prepares to spend the winter in Bristol's docks, Dialect's Tony Gosling has been finding out from the horse's mouth what it's like to captain these historic ships. As they approached Avonmouth docks from the direction of Steep Holm, he spoke to the SS Balmoral's Captain Edward Davies earlier in the season about the wonders of modern navigation.
My name is Davis, Edward Davis. I live near Newport in South Wales, and I've been associated with this ship for 23 years. I have been captain on other types of ship, coastal oil tankers, UK coast, European coast, and for 5.5 years I was captain of a molasses tanker based in the Caribbean, South America. I've been associated with this ship since 1986, not continually, but some years for the whole season as captain or as chief officer, other seasons just for 2 or 3 weeks to allow the other chaps to get off for a spot of leave. But each year, as I say, I've done several weeks on board minimum. This year and last year, I've done the whole season as master, and I'm also employed on the Waverley from time to time. She's the other ship which is operated by this company. Both ships are in the business of carrying passengers on day coastal excursions, different parts of the UK. 2 months of the year we're down here in the Channel, and the Waverley spends 2 months of her life, of her season, based on the Firth of Clyde. We've also covered the east coast of England this year, the southeast coast of England and the Thames, the south coast of England, Southampton, Bournemouth, Weymouth, Bridport and Dorset. This ship continuing on the Channel until the middle of September. The Waverley will be leaving the Clyde. She's destined for her south coast season based in Southampton and Bournemouth. She's there for a couple of weeks before she heads off to the Thames for her southeast of England season. And then she heads back to the Clyde in the middle of October to close the season, the second weekend of October. Both ships are then laid up. This one lays up for the winter in Bristol City Docks, and the Waverley lays up at a home berth in Glasgow on the River Clyde. The business of carrying passengers on this type of outing ceased to be a commercial operation about 50 years ago. Neither ship could continue to exist on what they earn by passengers coming up the gangway. Both ships are heavily dependent upon the generosity and kindness too, I suppose, shown to the organisation by many, many regional councils in Scotland, England and Wales, many harbour authorities and pilotage authorities. The Welsh, English and Scottish Tourist Board all play an active part in sustaining the operation of these ships. As I say, commercially, this sort of outing ceased in the 50s. 50 years ago, there were perhaps 7 or 8 ships in this channel earning a living from April until the end of October carrying people. But in this part of the world, the advent of the motor car, the opening of the first Severn Bridge in 1966, spelt the end of this type of operation as a commercial business. One example on our starboard side, now we're just passing Weston-super-Mare. 50 years ago, there would be 6 or 7 ships carrying passengers from Newport, Cardiff, Penarth and Barry over to Weston-super-Mare via the pier at Birnbeck Island for a family day out. In fact, on a Sundays, they were even more popular because in those days there was no pubs in Wales that were open on a Sunday, so people would go over to Birnbeck Pier at Weston. They'd venture no further than the Burnbeck Island, where the pier was, and spend the whole day there, perhaps forgetting where they had been by the time they got back to Wales in the evening. With the 19 crew on here, British captain, chief officer, chief engineer, British purser, and shopkeeper, volunteer shopkeeper. The deck crew are from Poland. The catering crew are from Latvia. The cook's Polish, second engineer from Latvia. He's been with us 2 years. Why do we have a European crew instead of British? Because for years, the standard of the British crew declined. The quality, their ability to stick out the season on something that was 50 or 60 years old, many of them couldn't hack it. This is a manual steered ship. She doesn't have automatic pilot. And it's all done a joint effort, really. The two engineers on the controls below and myself and the bosun up here. Our cargo are passengers, are people. And we obviously take more care of passengers than we would a cargo of coal or sheep. Our certification does not allow us to take passengers out in weather conditions that you would encounter as part of your normal day if you were captain on a coastal ship carrying a cargo of coal or containers or even oil. But we are restricted in the types of weather that we can go out in, unlike cargo ships, which are often at the influence of the office at the end of the telephone and venture off regardless of the weather. But we're not. We're not allowed to venture out in bad weather. Well, this ship was constructed in Southampton. The Waverley was constructed on Clydebank. This ship has been preserved, and perhaps this ship and the Waverley are a little bit like Elizabeth Taylor. There's not much of the original left. However, this ship was the engine 6 years ago with the assistance of the Heritage Lottery. The Waverley was virtually rebuilt, similarly, in two phases. Again, she was completely stripped out, like an empty big bean tin, and everything removed, lots of hull, plate in the new, and came out to the standard of a modern ship. Essentially, she looks 60 years old, as this ship has been treated. And hopefully, next winter, if funding is available again from the lottery people, then they hope to modernise our rather dated accommodation, which does date from 1949. It's hardly the Hilton Hotel. Well, this is an electronic chart system, which is a very modern piece of equipment. It's connected to the GPS satellite navigation system. It's an Admiralty chart where the ship superimposed upon it. Very accurate, very useful piece of navigation equipment. It's an aid to navigation. It's not the be-all and end-all. When this ship was in operation 20, 30 years ago, she might have had a radar set fitted. Now we've got a very modern, two modern radars on board, a modern echo sounder on board. We have this navigation chart, just the electronic chart connected to the satellite system. But essentially, ships made their way up and down this channel, or made their way up and down the oceans, purely on a man steering the ship and a magnetic compass in front of him. Even in my time at sea, certainly from when I went to sea in the late 60s until the mid-late 70s, we were navigating ships around the globe, big supertankers from Europe to the Persian Gulf, cargo ships across the Atlantic through the Panama Canal over to New Zealand and Australia on a sextant. When I was third and second mate, we would take morning and noon sights and fix the ship's position to an accuracy of a couple of miles and be able to predict what time we were going to arrive at Wellington in New Zealand when we were still 10, 14 days away, based purely upon the accuracy of our sextant calculations. Having been associated with this ship for so long and this channel for so long, this electronic chart is a very useful piece of equipment. However, I've been up here that long that I know where I am when I just look out of the wheelhouse window. I can pinpoint where I am quite easily, been so familiar, I suppose, like a taxi driver driving down Cardiff. I can pinpoint where we are, but just by looking out the window.
Captain Edward Davies of the SS Balmoral there talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. And if you're inquisitive, you should be able to find his ship, the SS Balmoral, in the Bristol docks over the winter. And if you like, you may even be able to join the small crew of volunteers that use the winter as an opportunity to restore ageing parts of this historic but very hard-working vessel.
And on a seafaring note, just to conclude that, we do not have any Treasure Island this week. We will do next week, we hope. But we'd like to mention that Malcolm Grieve has a second piece of work available on the US audio magazine Tales of Old. It's called Theatre Conundrum and can be downloaded from talesofold.org. Philip Lyons is in the studio and he's going to share some poetry with us. Philip, hello.
Hello, John. Thank you very much. This is a poem called O Bard, which is the first poem in my collection, Like It Is. O Bard. There is a moment when the song begins, when light peels back the darkness and I sing, when leaf by leaf the tree assumes its shape, when I reclaim my throne within its crown. I sing because the life force tells me to, because there is so little time to sing, because my heart is full and fit to burst, because I must, because I can. You wake to hear me drowsing in your bed. You wake and think of how you woke before, awake in darkness, everything quite still, awake and waiting for the night to end. You fall asleep and I become your dream, become the music you are following, become a forest where a river flows, become a glade where you can rest at last. There is a moment when the song begins. This is a poem called Her Father's Hands. I have her father's hands, same ape-like hair, though mine show fewer signs of wear and tear, and treat her kinder than her father's did. She holds one for a second, lifts the lid, and tries to read the lifeline written there. I take it back. We're not supposed to touch. But she has touched me more than she can know. Her depthless eyes can only say so much, and when she speaks, her words are hard and slow. Her father's hands will never let her go. Sometimes she shouts to get us all to hear. Sometimes she's silent, pretending to be dumb. She walks around the room or sucks her thumb. She's living on the knife edge of her fear, in prison now until the doctors come.
Philip Lyons, thank you very much, and we'll hear more hopefully in the coming weeks.
Now over to Jeff Sparks for his What Song Guide and Song of the Week. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What Song Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 3rd of November, Gordon Geltrap will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On Friday, 4th of November, the multi-influence group Clumsy will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Entry is free and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Michael Munro. In his career spanning over 20 years, he's been the founding member of Hanoi Rocks, performed in groups such as Demolition 23 and also Jerusalem Slim, and currently is performing with a band that includes Steve Conte of New York Dolls, Sammy Yaffa of Hanoi Rocks, Dragon of Backyard Babies, and Carl Rockfest of Danzig. This is from his most recent album, Sensory Overdrive, and is a song titled Bombs Away.
Back. Now that I'm all dizzy, where was I?
That was Michael Monroe with Bombs Away from his most recent album, Sensory Overdrive. For more information, you can check out www.michaelmonroe.com. And so Saturday, the 5th of November, the punk tribute group No More Heroes will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 6th of November, the American heavy metal group Iced Earth will be performing with support from White Wizard and Fury UK at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £17.50 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. And that's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's all from Dialect this week. Thank you to our guests, Janine Marriott and also Robin Whitlock. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. And we have some poetry courtesy of Philip Lyons.
We had the Sofa Sessions with Michael Noyce and the What's On Guide by Jeff Sparks. The engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer this week was also Jeff Sparks.
The presenters were John Peters Coleman
and Michaela Dennis
and the ghost of Derek Nemo. So until next week, happy Halloween. Goodbye.
Sugar, better leave town if you only want to knock us. Stop the time, the pressure of the class.